Dr. Philip Ball is here. He received his PhD from Bristol University in theoretical physics and condensed matter. He worked then for the very prestigious science journal Nature for over 20 years as an editor, and all the while writing books. He has several books to his name, looking at the interactions between science and art and wider culture. It's a pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Philip Ball, here to share how science became interested in everything. Dr. Ball.
Well, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be invited here, and I must say I'm deeply impressed by how well supported these lectures are. I think it's extraordinary, and a testament to, I think, how interested people are in finding out more about science. And I suspect that certainly for any of you who've been to previous lectures in these series, that you will, on the whole, be hearing from people who are telling you about some of the advances at the forefront of science. What I want to do tonight is to take us back and to have a look at how science got to be in this place that it is today. But I want to start, actually, also at the forefront of science. And this will be a site that is certainly familiar to anyone here who's from the Perimeter Institute, because it is the LHC itself at Geneva in Switzerland. This is a project that, of course, we have collectively spent somewhere in the region of about $8 to $9 billion in building. Despite some slightly half-hearted attempts to suggest that there are going to be practical spin-offs from this investment, I think it's clear that the main and the proper justification for it is pure curiosity about the profound questions that the LHC is now exploring. According to CERN's former Director General, Robert Amar, the LHC is continuing a tradition of human curiosity that's as old as mankind itself. And at a time when scientists are being increasingly told that they have to justify what they're doing in economic terms, this defense of science motivated by nothing more than pure inquisitiveness is essential. But Amar's image of a long-standing tradition of curiosity, although it's one that's widely shared by scientists, is, I think, too simplistic. This impulse to explore and find out about our environment has no doubt always been with us. There's an evolutionary benefit to doing that, and we're not the only animals to do it. But curiosity is a much more subtle and many-faceted notion, and our relationship to it has fluctuated over the ages. And we're unlikely to do justice to what curiosity in science could and should mean today unless we understand this history. And that's what I want to explore tonight. For a start, the word itself has many meanings. In fact, it's had too many to identify any core idea to them all at all. In earlier times, a curious person could indeed be one who is inquisitive, but could equally well be someone who took great care in what they did. Curiosity and care share the same Latin root. And it's not just people, but objects, too, that might be described as curious. And to call an object curious might mean that it was rare, exotic, elegant, collectible, valuable, small, hidden, useless, expensive, or conversely, in some contexts, common, useful, or cheap. And while in some sense this story of curiosity is indeed as old as humankind itself, its most significant phase occurs in the 17th century, because during that period, the concept of being curious went through a profound transformation. We can say that this is the time when curiosity went from being a vice to being a virtue. And some inkling of that change can be seen just by counting up the number of times curiosity or curious are used in books of that period. And if we do that, we see something like this. And you can see that in this admittedly rough and ready way, you can almost pinpoint the time that an interest in curiosity took off to around the middle of the 17th century. So What happened to make that possible? Well, this enthusiasm for curiosity and for curiosities arose outside of the mainstream academic tradition at that time. Until the late Renaissance, curiosity in the sense that is normally implied today, that is, an investigation driven purely by the wish to know, this was something that was condemned. Now, you might say, well, surely the ancient Greeks were curious. Well, they were undoubtedly interested in how nature works, but they certainly wouldn't have characterized that interest as curiosity. For one thing, there was a clear sense that they had of what was an appropriate and an inappropriate focus for the attention of natural philosophers. There was a hierarchy of relevance. What mattered were not minute particulars of how nature was, but the general rules that it seemed to follow. And curiosity itself was considered not to be a desire for knowledge, but an unwelcome distraction from attaining it. For Aristotle, curiosity had little part to play in philosophy. It was a kind of aimless, witless tendency to pry into things that didn't concern us. Plutarch considered curiosity to be the vice of busybodies who went around snooping into the affairs of others. In early Christianity, it was worse than that, because curiosity wasn't merely frowned upon, it was deemed to be sinful. The second century Christian writer Tertullian warned that we want no curious disputation after possessing Christ Jesus, no inquisition after enjoying the gospel. The Bible told us all we needed and all we should expect to know, and it made clear that there were some things we were supposed not to know. God was said to have created Adam last during the creation so that he couldn't see how the rest of the job was done. And, of course, desire for forbidden knowledge is what led to the fall. And the transgressive aspect of curiosity is an insistent theme in early Christian theology, which time and again demanded that we respect the limits of inquiry and be wary of too much learning. Deuteronomy says that the secret things belong to the Lord our God. And in Ecclesiastes, Solomon declares that we should be not curious in unnecessary matters, for more things are showed unto thee than men understand. For St. Augustine in the 5th century, curiosity became a disease. He called it, he said it was one of the vices or lusts at the root of all sin. And he wrote that it is in the divine language called the lust of the eyes. He claimed that curiosity is apt to pervert us towards a love of grotesque and superficially amazing things. So in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance, curiosity was viewed with a great deal of suspicion, if not outright condemnation. It was a vice. And there was clearly a lot of work to be done before the early modern scientists of the 17th century, people like Galileo, Johannes Kepler, Robert Boyle, Robert Hooke, and Isaac Newton, before they could give free rein to their curiosity. Popular accounts of this so-called scientific revolution often seem to imply that these men began to ask questions simply because of their great genius. Now, needless to say, it wasn't as simple as that. Undoubtedly, they all did have exceptional minds, but exceptional minds weren't in themselves somehow an invention of the 17th century. So what was it that enabled curiosity to flourish at this time? Well, I think that it's possible to identify at least some of the factors behind that. And one of them was the influence of the Renaissance itself, and in particular, the emergence of the tradition of humanism, which reformed culture and education by challenging the medieval tradition of scholasticism. And this was a tradition that tended to pursue learning by rote and by pedantically dissecting a very limited body of classical texts. Humanism made it acceptable to challenge this ancient knowledge, and it emphasized the benefits of writing clearly and eloquently, rather than in the dense, jargon-strewn manner that that many academics at the universities favored. The influence of humanism first made itself felt in theology and law and rhetoric and art, but it also affected scientific areas such as medicine and natural philosophy. And here, thinking had long been dominated by a few classical scholars, in particular by Aristotle in physics and by Hippocrates and Galen in medicine. And various scholars, often at the fringes of or outside of the academic world, began to suggest that perhaps these ancients didn't know everything after all, and that perhaps the best way to find out about the world was not to read old books, but to rely on experience to try things out for ourselves. Or in other words, and we have to be careful about the way we use this word in this particular context, but in other words, to experiment. And prominent among these people were, here's two of them, and these were both Italians, Bernardino Telesio and Girolamo Cardano. Now, I suspect these names may be unfamiliar to a lot of people. They certainly don't tend to appear in most histories of science. And one reason for that is that what they believed about the world is very much in accord with a tradition known as natural magic. And that, of course, makes it sound like the antithesis of science. But we have to overcome our modern prejudices about this word to understand what it means, because natural magic didn't mean superstitions and spells, but more or less the exact opposite. It was a belief that nature was governed by occult forces, and that literally means that they're hidden forces, they're invisible. And of course, people could see even then that such forces do exist. Magnetism is one of them, and so indeed is gravity. And it's precisely because Isaac Newton was an heir to this natural magic tradition of occult forces that he was prepared to invoke this kind of force to explain the movements of the planets. So these hidden forces provided a framework for understanding a wide range of natural phenomena according to strictly mechanistic and rational principles. And they helped to erode the kind of tautological explanation for things that Aristotle had offered. After all, which explanation would you rather have for why bodies fall to the earth? Is it because it's in their nature to do so, as Aristotle would have said? Or is it because there's some occult force that's pulling them down? Perhaps the definitive work on this view of the world was one published in the middle of the 16th century, simply called Natural Magic. It was published in 1558 by another Italian, and probably one of the most underrated of the predecessors of the scientists of the following century. And his name was Giambattista della Porta. And in the late 16th century, he was one of the most celebrated natural philosophers in Italy. Della Porta's book is a fantastical mixture of old recipes and almost like parlor tricks, mixed up with important investigations of subjects such as optics, in which, for example, he more or less describes how to build a telescope. When Della Porta wrote that magic is nothing else but the knowledge of the whole course of nature, you need only replace magic here with science to bring this statement up to date. Della Porta's Natural Magic portrayed nature as a treasure trove of secrets that can and should be pried open. And that image of secrets more or less characterizes the scientist's view of the world for at least the next 100 years, and arguably it still applies today. And Della Porta didn't pursue this mission alone. Instead, he convened at his home in Naples one of the first proto-scientific societies. It was called the Accademia dei Secreti, the Academy of Secrets, who came together to tease out nature's secrets by careful observation. At least, they did so until the 1570s, when they were closed down by the Inquisition. And if that sounds familiar, just wait, there's more. But societies like this began to spring up all over Italy in the late 16th century, dedicated to the study of nature. And one of the most significant of them began in 1603 at the instigation of a young nobleman, a young Duke of Umbria called Federico Chiesi. And this society had it in its beginning, just 4 members. They were all idealistic young men, like Chiesi himself. And they imagined themselves as keen-eyed observers of nature. This was a legendary attribute of the lynx. And so they called themselves the Accademia dei Lincei, the Academy of Lynxes. Now, Chiesi's father would have none of this, and he ordered his son to disband the group. But when the father died in 1610, Chiesi lost no time in resurrecting his plans. And at this time, he wrote to the now elderly Della Porta in Naples and asked him to become the 5th member of the Academy, which Della Porta did. A year later, the Academy acquired its sixth member when Chazy went to a banquet held in honor of an astronomer who had just astounded all of Europe with a booklet describing new discoveries that he'd made with the telescope. And this was how Della Porta found himself in an exclusive little club with this chap, Galileo. Now, Galileo was clearly proud to be one of these lynxes. He displayed the Academy's crest on several of his works, which were often paid for by Chazy. And had Chazy not suddenly died in 1630, it seems quite possible that his diplomacy would have smoothed the feathers in Rome that Galileo was apt to ruffle, so that Galileo's notorious book on the Copernican system wouldn't have angered the church and led to his persecution. Now, that's another story, but the book that brought Galileo to Chazy's attention illustrates another aspect of this emancipation of curiosity. This was a book called Sidereus Nuncius, the Celestial Messenger, and in it, Galileo announced that using this newly invented telescope, he had seen four new stars, as he referred to them. They're actually moons orbiting the planet Jupiter. And he also reported that our own moon was not the perfect smooth sphere that Aristotelians had argued that it was, but that instead it was rugged. It had mountains and valleys. And Galileo explained that you could see these revealed by the highlights and the shadows that were visible through the telescope as light glanced across the moon's surface and as you looked at the border of the sunlit and the dark regions. So, in other words, the moon, Galileo said, was a world rather like ours. This revelation of new worlds is a recurrent theme during the liberation of curiosity. Galileo's discoveries impressed writers and poets such as John Donne and John Milton, who refer to them time and again. Galileo's observation that the Milky Way is not some cloudy vapor, but is actually millions of stars, left them astonished at the scale of the universe and the multiplicity of the worlds that it contained, making our own home planet seem even more puny and incidental. Donne put it this way. He said, "Men that inhere upon nature only are so far from thinking that there is anything singular in this world that they will scarce think that this world is itself singular, but that every planet and every star is another world like this. They find reason to conceive not only a plurality in every species in the world, but a plurality of worlds." This awesome infinite void is precisely the view we see in Paradise Lost. John Milton visited Galileo under house arrest, and he probably looked through Galileo's telescopes, and he described what he saw there much more memorably than Galileo himself did. He said, he called it a broad and ample road whose dust is gold and pavement stars, as stars to thee appear, seen in the galaxy, that Milky Way which nightly as a circling zone thou seest powdered with stars. And these visions of new worlds in the cosmos spawned a whole literature of space travel in the 17th century. One of the founders of the Royal Society in Britain, John Wilkins, gave the first factual picture of the moon as another world in a book of 1638 called Discovery of a New World in the Moon. But he'd already been anticipated there in a work of proto-science fiction written around 1628 by Francis Godwin, who was at that time the Bishop of Hereford. And this book was called The Man in the Moon. And Godwin's hero in this book reached the moon by tethering a craft to giant geese, which migrated there annually. Now, this sounds crazy today, but it was a possibility that, you know, people had no reason to discount. And in fact, Wilkins took it seriously in his own book 10 years later. Other cosmic voyage books followed. Most notably, there were two novels by Cyrano de Bergerac called The States and Empires of the Moon and The States and Empires of the Sun. Now, it's not widely known, I suspect, that Cyrano de Bergerac isn't just a fictional character with a big nose in a 19th century play. He was actually, that character was actually very, very loosely based on a real person, a French soldier and writer. And Cyrano's space voyager a man called Dirkona, used an even fantastic means of traveling to the moon than Godwin's. He began more or less conventionally by creating a kind of spacecraft that had explosives attached to it. But that didn't work. In fact, it crashed. And Dirkona thought at first that he'd crashed in France. It turned out he'd crashed in New France, which, of course, is right here, or perhaps a little further east. I'm not sure, but it's in Canada. And he is covered in bruises from this accident. And so he rubs on these bruises bone marrow, which was thought to heal bruises. But it was also thought at that time that it has an occult attraction to the moon. And so he suddenly finds himself rising up to the moon, and that's how he gets there. Now, he gets to the sun in a slightly more apparently scientific means. He builds a kind of spacecraft that makes use of a vacuum. A vacuum is formed, and the air rushing in to fill this vacuum propels it up to the sun. Now, as all of these works testify, there was another influence on this interest in new worlds at this time, and that was, naturally enough, the discovery of this new world, the voyages to America. Several writers who speculated about the exploration of new worlds in the cosmos, including John Wilkins and Johannes Kepler, drew explicit parallels with the colonialist voyages of Columbus. And ever since Columbus had returned to Europe, Europeans had been coming to terms with the realization that there was more in the world, more people, more customs, plants, animals, medicines, minerals, than you could find in the classical works of writers like Aristotle or Pliny. And this supplied a fresh spur to curiosity, sharpened now by the possibility of exploiting these newfound riches for commercial gain. One of the first detailed accounts of the flora and fauna and races of the New World, species like these here, one of the first accounts was given in 1588 by the English mathematician and astronomer Thomas Harriot, who travelled with Francis Drake to the land that Drake christened Virginia, which is actually now part of North Carolina. And Harriot was one of the first to use a telescope. In fact, he drew the same conclusions that Galileo had about the topography of the moon, and he probably saw that a few months before Galileo did. So these explorers, voyaging both east and west from Europe, brought back many specimens that were avidly collected by rich people in Europe, because collecting rare and precious natural objects had become an obsession amongst European nobles at that time. And they displayed these collections in so-called cabinets of curiosities. And to many of the earliest collectors, these treasure troves were symbols of power, not just or not even primarily because of their financial value, but because they were supposed to represent a kind of world in microcosm. The Flemish physician Samuel Kieschenberg, who looked after the collection of the Duke of Bavaria, called the cabinet a theatre of knowledge. It was a kind of stylized representation of all that could be thought of or seen in the world. A cabinet, as you can see here, wasn't literally a single piece of furniture. It was any enclosed space, and some of the big cabinets might occupy several rooms, usually crammed with these objects from floor to ceiling. By possessing this microcosm, the noble collector wasn't just symbolizing, but also, in a sense, exercising his mastery of the world. The cabinet acted as a sort of mental laboratory within which the relationships between things could be contemplated in a process that has elements both of experimentation and of mystical revelation. So this was a pre-scientific mode of finding or of asserting order in the world. The cabinet was a conduit to deep knowledge about the order of things. Now, these cabinets didn't generally try to be comprehensive, but they tended to place emphasis on things that were strange and unusual. But some collectors, such as the physician Ulisse Aldrovandi at the University of Bologna in Italy, really did try to get a bit of everything that was to be found in the world, every plant, every animal and mineral, and that he tried to do this for the purposes of serious study, not just a display of power. So by the mid-17th century, a collection tended to be something between the old-style cabinet of curiosities and now a repository of samples of natural history. One of the finest collections in England was that owned by the botanist John Tredescant, who was Charles I's gardener. And he started to allow visitors into his house in South London to see his collection if they paid a modest fee at the door. In other words, this had become essentially a museum. A German traveller in 1638 gave an account of what you could find in Tredescant's collection, and this is just a bit of it. He said you could find two ribs of a whale, a very ingenious little boat of bark, all kinds of foreign plants, a salamander, a chameleon, a pelican, a white partridge, a goose which has grown in Scotland on a tree, a flying squirrel, another squirrel like a fish, all kinds of bright-coloured birds from India, a number of things changed into stone, amongst others a piece of human flesh on a bone, gourds, olives, a piece of wood, an ape's head, a cheese, all kinds of shells, the hand of a mermaid, the hand of a mummy, all kinds of precious stones, a small piece of wood from the cross of Christ, pictures in perspective of Henry IV and Louis VIII of France, and so on and so on. After the death of Tredescant's son in 1662, this collection was acquired by the English antiquarian Elias Ashmole, and he bequeathed it to Oxford University on condition that it be housed in a grand building named after him. And this was the first genuine museum in England, which was the famous Ashmolean Museum. Another avid collector in the late 17th century was an Irish physician named Hans Sloane, who'd become fabulously wealthy by selling some of the imports from the New World, such as quinine and chocolate. Sloane succeeded Isaac Newton as president of the Royal Society, he collected over 70,000 plants and exotic materials and other objects, and he passed these on to the crown, to the King George II after his death, for the benefit of mankind. This collection formed the basis of what became the British Museum, which opened its doors in 1753. So, by the middle of the 17th century, all the elements were in place for an institutionalized program of curiosity. The notion of a scientific society was well established, especially in Italy. There was a tradition of finding out about the world from experimentation and observation, and the telescope had shown the advantages of using instruments to enhance human perception, and by the 1620s, the microscope had been invented too. Also in the 1620s, the English philosopher Francis Bacon had argued the case for why a systematic program of knowledge collection based on these principles and instituted by a kind of scientific brotherhood would be valuable to the state. And it was in this context that a group of natural philosophers gathered around John Wilkins while he was warden of Wadham College in Oxford to form what they called an experimental club for pursuing and popularizing this experimental philosophy. And this group moved back to London after the restoration of Charles II in 1660, and they took to meeting in Gresham College. And in November of 1660, they decided to formalize their meetings, and they applied for a royal charter to create what became known as the Royal Society. But it's not at all clear that this society was engaged in some fledgling form of modern science. You can see that just by considering the contents of the first volume of the Society's Journal of Record, the Philosophical Transactions, which first appeared in early 1665, and it contained, amongst other things, an account of the improvement of optic glasses at Rome, of the observation made in England of a spot in one of the belts of the planet Jupiter, an experimental history of cold, a relation of a very odd monstrous calf, of a new American whale fishing about the Bermudas, a narrative concerning the success of the pendulum watches at sea for the longitudes, an account of the philosophical books published by Monsieur de Fermat, counselor at Toulouse, lately dead. So in other words, a rather random collection of wonders, reminding you of nothing so much as the list of John Tredescant's Cabinet of Curiosities. And this pretty well illustrates the Royal Society's purpose, as it was described at that time by a man called Thomas Spratt, who wrote an account of what the Society was doing in 1667. And he explained that they tried not to develop hypotheses and theories, but simply to accumulate knowledge, to accumulate reports, or as they called them then, histories. In other words, in the early days, they just collected facts. Many of those facts were strange and fantastical, just as many of the objects that collectors of curiosities had also been strange and fantastical. How do you turn all of this into a science worthy of the name? You can see what a challenge that was by looking at the notebooks of the Royal Society's most illustrious member in the 17th century. This wasn't Isaac Newton. It was the Anglo-Irish scientist Robert Boyle, most famous now for his chemical work. And he kept notebooks in which he made lists. Here are some of them. Lists of things to remember to investigate. Or as he sometimes put it, lists of things to remember. So remember, he said, the use of a coach, the eyes of puppies newly whelped, the feathers, claws, and beaks of birds yet in the shell, insects and other creatures that lie, as it were, dead in the winter, Moses' serpent and the transmuted water, monsters and the longings and frights of teeming women. Not sure what that's about. Now, we can see now, though, what has changed by this stage in the nature of curiosity. Because in earlier ages, questions about nature had tended to limit themselves to what was obviously useful or important or universal. Why plants grow, why winds blow, why we get sick, how the stars and planets progress across the sky. But now, nothing was out of bounds. Any question was permissible, however odd or seemingly inconsequential. At the Royal Society, the slightest blemish seen on the surface of a distant planet might spark earnest and learned debate, or why fleas can jump so high, or why concentric coloured rings could be seen in flakes of mineral under the microscope. And this glimpse of Boyle's restless mind hints at the problem of this sort of eclecticism. How do you make sense of it all? If you can ask anything, then there's no end to these questions. How do you organize the observations? How do you decide which phenomena are important and which are frivolous? Perhaps nothing is truly frivolous, but then the task of science seems hopeless. Now, Boyle's approach is illustrated in his most famous set of experiments, which make use of a device designed and built for him largely by his assistant, Robert Hooke. And here it is, it's his air pump. And this used a hand pump to withdraw all the air from this glass sphere at the top to create a near vacuum inside. Or did it? That was the crucial question. Aristotle was responsible for the well-known idea that nature abhors a vacuum, and most Aristotelians understood this to mean that nature won't allow a vacuum to exist. That was thought to be the reason why water could be pumped uphill, because water would rush up to fill a space emptied of air by a pump. But some philosophers, such as Galileo's one-time collaborator Evangelista Torricelli, took the view that nature simply made sure that a vacuum was no larger than it absolutely needed to be. And Torricelli had an experiment that he thought showed this. What he did was to take a tube, really a long, thin test tube, fill it up with mercury, and invert it in a dish of mercury. And when he did this, he saw that the level of mercury falls a little, and there's this space at the top. And the question is, what's in that space, if anything? Is it a vacuum? Robert Boyle decided to study this experiment in his air pump. So he put it inside this glass sphere and pumped all the air out. And he found that the level of mercury fell and fell and fell, apparently supporting Torricelli's view that the level was determined not so much by how much nature abhors a vacuum, but by the pressure of air pressing down on the mercury in the dish. But Boyle didn't get into that. He wouldn't say whether his pump created a vacuum or not, because like most fellows of the Royal Society, he was reluctant to make interpretations or hypotheses. He simply recorded what he saw in his experiments as accurately as he could. And in the air pump, he found all sorts of phenomena took place. He found that candles go out. He found that small animals get rather poorly. These are experiments depicted very vividly a century later in this painting by Joseph Wright of Derby, who I think alludes here. You see it's actually an experiment being done on a dove. You can just about see it in this glass sphere. And I think Wright of Derby is alluding here to the idea that the experimental philosopher is still not so far removed from the natural magician or the medieval mystic in receiving inspiration and understanding literally as a kind of divine illumination. Now, to some people who were opposed to this experimental philosophy, such as the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, Boyle's air pump studies epitomized the problems with this whole approach, this whole use of experiment, because Hobbes objected to the idea that you could find out about nature by using complicated instruments and devices that create states that don't exist in nature, such as globes emptied of air, or lenses that magnify and perhaps distort light. Today, the use of scientific instruments is relatively uncontroversial. No one seems to worry that the Large Hadron Collider is claiming to pronounce on the beginnings of creation by creating conditions that don't really exist today in nature, not least creating a vacuum more extreme than that in interstellar space. But the validity of doing that wasn't at all obvious when modern science was beginning. And it was partly because of such criticisms that the Royal Society needed to create procedures and conventions that were designed to be persuasive. They needed, for example, to decide whose testimony could be trusted and to walk a delicate tightrope between being open-minded and being just credulous. And scientists like Boyle began to develop what the historian Stephen Chapin has called a literary technology, a way of reporting their findings that was tailored to convey authority with rhetorical tricks, such as the dispassionate, disembodied tone that now characterizes, and some might say now blights, the scientific literature. Well, if Boyle was renowned for his air pump, what made Robert Hooke famous was his experiments with the microscope. And these two gained authority and impact from the way that Hooke presented them, most memorably by his extraordinary drawings in a book printed at large scale in 1665 called Micrographia. The diarist Samuel Pepys, who was one of the many fellows of the Royal Society who went along to enjoy these experiments without really understanding what was going on, he rushed out and bought Hooke's book as soon as it was published, and he called it the most ingenious book that I ever read in my life. Now, Hooke was quite careful and canny about the trajectory in which he presented his results in Micrographia. So it began with mundane peculiarities of human art, of things humans make, what printed letters looked like under the microscope, or the texture of cloth. And then it moved through minerals like sand and charcoal to the vegetable world of mold and sponges and seeds, and it includes the first description of biological cells seen here in a slice of cork. And then it culminates with the amazing spectacle of the insect world, using specimens that were mostly not killed before put on the slide. They were just drugged with brandy, because Hooke found that if you kill them, they shrivel up, and that's no good. However, this one certainly was killed and decapitated, sadly. This is the head of a fly. Hooke alludes to the multifaceted spectacle of these eyes, this infinite regress of gazes that he saw in seeing this vision, by claiming rather fancifully, I think, that he could see reflected in each one of these tiny facets the window of his laboratory and the tree that stood outside it. Confronted with this sort of intricacy, Hooke sensed the dizzying infinite scope of God's power. He said, "There may be as much curiosity of contrivance in every one of these pearls as in the eye of a whale or elephant, and the Almighty's fiat could as easily cause the existence of the one as the other. And as one day and 1,000 years are the same with him, so may one eye and 10,000. So here again is an evocation of new worlds, this time worlds in miniature, You might say it's the awesome vista of Milton's Paradise Lost through the other end of the telescope, an endless expanse converging on the infinitely small. Now, if this fine-grained intricacy of the world presented the natural philosopher with the happy prospect of finding riches wherever he looked, it also eroded distinctions about where one should look. In the dust on the shelf and in the mold in the larder, there was more than enough to occupy the curious mind for days, weeks, perhaps a lifetime. You could almost be forgiven for suspecting that the early microscopists were unduly drawn towards the lowliest forms of matter, to cinders and decay, to urine and feces, to spit and sperm. To investigate what he called the gravel found in urine, Hooke apparently went round scooping out deposits from urinals in London. Now, to find things like this worthy of serious examination could seem to people outside not merely perverse, but perverted. And that was a real problem for the Royal Society, that what they were up to often looked very odd to the world outside. Now, although some people continued to disapprove of these activities on the grounds that they were impious, there was now far more harm from the risk of ridicule. And Hooke was reminded of that in 1676 when he went to see a new play by the well-known playwright Thomas Shadwell called The Virtuoso. This turned out to be a satire on the activities of the Royal Society that was personified by a bumptious clown called Sir Nicholas Gimcrack. And he first appears in the play in his study, lying face down on his table and imitating the motions of a frog. And he explains to his visitors that he's learning to swim, but he's doing that just by focusing on the theory. And the implication was that this was all the fellows of the Royal Society were doing, wasting their days in absurd activities that had no practical benefit. Worst of all, Hooke realized that he was the model for Gimcrack. Shadwell's ridiculous virtuoso experiments with an air pump, and according to his niece, has spent £2,000 in microscopes to find out the nature of eels in vinegar, mites in a cheese, and the blue of plums. All of these things being things that Hooke had described in Micrographia. And the audiences loved it, including the Royal Society's patron, Charles II, who never really seemed to take their efforts very seriously. The poet Samuel Butler also lampooned the Royal Society on several occasions, especially in his poem The Elephant in the Moon, which tells of how a group of astronomers become very excited when they look through the telescope and they see warring armies on the moon, including great war elephants, and they start to spin all sorts of theories about these lunar races until they find that the creatures are actually just flies and gnats and a mouse that have become trapped in the telescope's tube. The most famous satire features in Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels. This talks about an island of Laputa, where Gulliver meets philosophers who are so wrapped up in thinking that they're always falling down holes or colliding with each other. And to avoid this, they have to employ servants who constantly follow them round with blown-up bladders that they use to hit them on the head to bring them back to reality. Laputa is a shambles because these professors endlessly dream up new schemes for making life better, but are incapable of putting any of them into practice. One professor is trying to reconstitute food from human excrement. Another one aims to distill sunbeams from cucumbers. And Thomas Spratt admitted that this mockery was more damaging to the experimental philosophers than any of their serious critics like Thomas Hobbes. Well, curiosity and science seem nevertheless to have survived those satirists. Although, of course, you don't have to look too far to find the same caricatures of unworldly boffins today. In fact, scientists now seem confident enough to flirt with these stereotypes themselves. That's something you see, for example, in the so-called Ig Nobel Prizes, which are awarded annually for research that is either spectacularly silly or, more often, just looks like it. And past winners include the real physics Nobel laureate, André Geim, who won it for the magnetic levitation of a frog. And yet, science still has a tricky relationship with curiosity. As I said at the beginning, there are very well-motivated complaints from many scientists that research driven purely by curiosity isn't supported or valued enough. But it seems they don't quite trust this argument, and so they yoke it to a utilitarian defense. They say you never know where curiosity might lead, and that important innovations and discoveries have often come from it. That's true enough, but it begins to seem increasingly tenuous and unlikely if applied to a project like the LHC. It seems that curiosity still can't quite be trusted to be its own justification. But perhaps it never has been. The history of curiosity suggests that it's always been accompanied by an agenda. For the Academies of Secrets, it was a desire for quasi-magical power to manipulate nature. For Francis Bacon, curiosity was an engine of state power. For Robert Boyle, it was a religious duty to understand all the corners of God's creation. Robert Hooke's voracious curiosity was accompanied by a desire for recognition. None of this is by any means to condemn those people's curiosity, but it does suggest that we might be more thoughtful sometimes about what is really driving curiosity today. Now, today, it often gets allied to wonder. Carl Sagan suggested that in gazing up at the skies, wonder precedes and inspires curiosity. For the physicist Richard Feynman, wonder is the reward and not the bait. He spoke for many scientists when he suggested that the curious study of nature can only increase our wonder at how it's put together. That's a claim I have a lot of sympathy with, but wonder is a slippery customer too. After all, wonder was once favored over curiosity by theologians because of its potential to leave us awed by and unquestioning of God's power. The common Latin word for wonder was stupor, something that was apt to leave us stupefied, if not, in fact, stupid. However, wonder and curiosity, in whatever combination, are now commonly used to justify big science projects like the LHC or like NASA's new Mars rover, which, if you've been paying attention at the beginning, you will have seen as actually called Curiosity, and has certainly provided us with these wonder-inspiring images of the red planet, or the Hubble Space Telescope, which presents images often coloured and cropped to hark back to 19th century depictions of wonder's elite relative, the sublime. But however well motivated they are, one has to ask how much room is left in huge, costly international collaborations like this for the sort of spontaneous curiosity that would allow Hooke or Boyle to follow their noses. Can we really have curiosity by committee, a consensus about where curiosity should be directing us? And that's why I think we shouldn't let big science blind us to the virtues of small science, of the benchtop experiment, the real heritage of Delaporte and Boyle and Hooke, which often makes do with cheap, improvised equipment and leaves space for trying out hunches and wild ideas, for reveling in little surprises and indulging in science as a craft. This, I think, was one of my favourite images of science, and I think it's very inspiring. This is the laboratory of Ernest Rutherford at Cambridge in 1926, and it's in circumstances and with equipment like this that Rutherford discovered the nucleus and split the atom. And here are just a few of my favourite modern examples of small science experiments. On the left here, you see these little isolated waves that will pop out of a tray of shaken metal grains and will start to arrange themselves into spectacular patterns. Here's the discovery that shampoo poured in the right way will bounce when it hits more shampoo. And these little smiley faces are each smaller than bacterial cells. They're made from folded up strands of bespoke artificial DNA designed to fold into these shapes. One scientist has called this the most concentrated form of happiness ever known. Experiments like these may turn out to be fantastically useful or spectacularly useless. They're the result of nothing more than the questions, can we do this? And what if we do that? They're each little acts of homage to curiosity and, in consequence, to our humanity.
So, do we have a question?
I'm kind of curious as to why curiosity took off in 17th century Europe as opposed to some other place in the world like China, which was quite technologically advanced, even more advanced than Europe, and or possibly North Africa or somewhere else in the world that still had access to Greek literature and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a very good question that I have been asked before, and I tend to slightly duck for the reason that, this is a question, it's the so-called Needham question, after Joseph Needham, who made a huge study of science in China, and the question was, and still is, very often asked, you know, why didn't science begin in China, which, as you say, was certainly during the Western Middle Ages and before, had always been technologically much more advanced than the West. And it's debated by historians and other scholars today. No one has a definitive answer. You can also, and people do also, ask the same question of the Arabic world in the Western Dark Ages, which had a far better knowledge of the information about the world that had been gathered in the in ancient Greece. And I think that the very fact that one can ask that question does show us that it's certainly simplistic to make an easy link between curiosity and the appearance of science and the appearance of technology and the ability to manipulate nature. Those things are, in some regards, distinct things and have to be seen as such. I suspect that the answer to that question must lie, and I think this is the consensus, must lie somewhere in the social and political systems that existed at that time. It seems very clear that one of the, among the motivating factors that allowed it to take off in Europe was the changing social and demographic factors, the emergence of this wealthy middle class that, if you like, had time on its hands, and the impulse to explore new worlds, which was largely a commercial impulse. It was feeding this mercantile system. So it has something to do, I'm sure, with that, amongst other things. But that's as far as I would dare go with that question.
I'll go to the Twitter sphere for this question from Yatin Sheik. Are there mathematical laws of curiosity? That is curiosity proportional to the number of unanswered questions?
I suspect folks at the Perimeter Institute will be starting to suspect that curiosity simply multiplies. It's a multiplier of unanswered questions. And it comes down to this question that once you can ask, once you're given permission to ask questions, they never stop. And each question, seems to spawn another, if not many others. In that sense, I guess one would have to hope that curiosity is never going to cease or run out of things to ask or to answer. Whether there are mathematical laws to it, I'd hesitate to say that. But I would say that there does seem to be an interesting correlation between curiosity and this cognate concept, wonder. And this is an interesting thing that's been explored, that the status of those things seems to have an inverse relationship to each other. So, as I said, in the Middle Ages, wonder was good, curiosity was bad. In the late Enlightenment and let's say towards the end of the 18th century, curiosity was good, wonder was bad. Wonder was this kind of stupefied, looking at the universe without just in awe and reverence and without asking anything about it. And I think it's significant that they cross over, if you like, precisely during the mid-17th century. And there, you know, maybe there's a sort of symbiotic relationship between them.
Thank you. I think we have a question on the left, my left.
Yeah. Are you suggesting perhaps that curiosity has lost its way, that's become too ends-oriented, too expensive, and that a return or partial return to a playfulness is what you're suggesting, or some sort of combination of both of them, or what?
I don't think it's lost its way. I think it's there's a perception that curiosity is struggling to find its way in an era that, you know, constantly wants to see what the bottom line is at an ever-shortening time horizon. You know, what is this going to contribute to the economy 5 years down the line? I think that's a real problem. I think it's a fairly sort of localized one. It's something that seems to have happened relatively recently, but it really is a problem. But I don't think that, I mean, I certainly don't suggest that experiments like the LHC are just too expensive and we shouldn't bother with them. In fact, you know, in some ways, quite the contrary, that is an experiment that is curiosity-led in some sense. But I think that the curiosity behind it is inevitably compromised by the scale of the operation. You know, just as it is for some other big science projects, for genomics, for example. And so I really just want to make a plea that we don't lose sight of small science. And I think, you know, what we increasingly tend to sort of hear about it's understandable that we hear a lot about big space projects and about, you know, the LHC and so on, and that's sort of quite right. But I think that it tends to give people the impression sometimes that this is what scientists do. They, you know, work on these huge things. Actually, most scientists are working at the benchtop in these, you know, doing small science. And I think that the wonderful thing that small science does allow you to do is to remain spontaneous and indeed, as we saw, genuinely playful. And I think that that is absolutely essential for a healthy science.
Let's take one more question to my left.
Do you have any examples in your book of necessity is the mother of invention? People who are curious because they see a need to find something out?
Well, I think it was very clear that this was behind a lot of what the early people in the Royal Society, and I should say there were other scientific institutions that followed on quite quickly from them throughout the rest of Europe. For the French Academy of Sciences was formed very soon afterwards. And what a lot of these scientific institutions were doing was driven very much by the perception that this new experimental philosophy had things to offer in a practical sense. You saw in the very first issue of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, they were thinking about longitude and the problems of that, of navigation. And, you know, navigation, and it has to be clearly admitted, military applications and military technology was driving some of this interest in mechanics and trajectories and laws of motion. You know, were clearly of interest to ballistics experts. So right from the start, there was the perception that, you know, one did this because there could be practical benefits from it. And in fact, Francis Bacon made that extremely clear. I think that Francis Bacon, the role that Francis Bacon's ideas played in the development of curiosity is a complex one, because he's often cited as as sort of proposing this scientific method and as someone who helped science get started. But actually, you know, he was really arguing the case that kings and nobles ought to support this because it'll increase their power. They'll have more, you know, their armies will be better. They'll be able to navigate better. So these practical applications were very much a selling point that he tried to use for why you needed this institutionalized program of what we now call science.
Let's end there. Dr. Ball, thank you very much. That was terrific.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good stuff.